I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, a dialogue partner of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which wraps up its Tianjin summit in China today. As a testament to the new power of the Global South, Russia's Vladimir Putin, China's Xi Jinping, India's Narendra Modi, Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and Iran's President Pezeshkian were just some of the world leaders charting the future of this century. SCO members are notable for ignoring NATO attempts to isolate Russia over the proxy war in Ukraine. Ukraine is a shadow from the last century, and here in the Middle East, Arab states, including the UAE and Saudi Arabia, are condemning another dark chapter in human history. Israel's genocidal war on Palestine, Gaza, is now being deliberately starved by UK-US EU-armed Israel. It is now officially declared a famine by the UN. Joining me again is Doug Bandow, former special assistant to US President Ronald Reagan. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He joins me now from Washington, D.C. Thanks, Doug, for coming back on away, but perhaps linked in a strange way. From the genocide and the proxy war, I have to quote your tweet directly, Doug. Karl Marx arises from his grave to applaud the use of double agent Trumpy POTUS, I know this humor, to establish socialism in America. Can internet providers, energy companies, and the banks be long behind you? What have you got against him taking 10% of Intel and some strategic industry? Don't you like the U.S. Postal Service? You want BlackRock to own everything?
Yeah. Hey, he's going to be taking a cut of sales of semiconductor chips.
Not
to,
he, the American people.
China. Yes. Well, we all know who's running this, and we all know who's spending the money. And of course, he also wants to own, it sounds like, the defense industrial base. And oh boy, that's a great one because the feds pay for it. The feds inflate the prices. The feds own it. Oh, my goodness. Where are we going on that?
Well, then why not just take it? I don't understand. I mean, it's not the ghost of Karl Marx in Highgate Cemetery. It's the ghost of Ronald Reagan that I'm looking at right now, Doug. I mean, come on. These companies are just subsidized. They're like Soviet Union companies anyway, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon,
oh, no, they're awful.
And everything. They,
no,
don't, I mean, they can't turn a profit without the U.S. taxpayer.
No, it's a problem where you have companies that are able to lobby for the very contracts they get, and they lobby, so even if they inflate the cost and they constantly inflate the cost, they get paid. It's a horrible system. It needs to be cleaned up. Part of it's Congress's fault. You know, Congress votes for stuff, and then they want to stretch it out. Everything costs more. You know, the General Accounting Office could never audit the Pentagon. It's extraordinary. You know, we have this huge department in the U.S. spending hordes of money, and the federal government kind of throws up its hands and says, who knows what it's doing?
People can watch our interview with Chuck Spinney, the great whistleblower of the Pentagon, about those contracts historically. But in all seriousness, I mean, surely when you compare the decline of the United States to the rise of China, the relative rise of Russia since 2022, now the largest economy in Europe by GDP, if you just look at life expectancy, you know, it's like South Dakota, 62.8. Union County, Florida, 67.6. In Cuba, it's 78. In Russia, 79. China, 79. I mean, I know those are just particular sectors. But then the big, beautiful bill gave $40.6 billion to Raytheon, $35 billion to Northrop, $33 billion to General Dynamics, and $32.7 billion to Boeing. Surely, taking a bit of Cuban socialism, Russian socialism, Chinese communism with, what is it? Capitalist characteristics? I'm not sure. It's communism with Chinese characteristics. Surely Trump is making the right decision here.
Well, I would feel better about it if I actually had an executive that I thought cared about cost and cared about streamlining the Pentagon and actually would put America's military.
You'd feel happier if Elon Musk was
far
there.
Far fewer places.
You'd feel happier if Elon Musk was running these state-owned enterprises.
Well, if Elon Musk had gone after the Pentagon like he went after USAID, that would have been fun. Because, talk about waste, fraud, and abuse, and, extraordinary waste. You know, it's the Pentagon. And that, it's a tragedy there. It's that no one watches it. The Pentagon says, hey, we're doing this to save America. Everybody says, oh, my God, and throws money at them. This is a disaster. It's just what Trump is proposing. I don't see anything to suggest he will manage it better. You know, he just wants to put his friends there. He wants to make sure that some of those contracts go to some of his friends, that kind of a thing. I don't see this as making anything more efficient, unfortunately.
I don't want to sound like one of those cabinet members around the table in those televised cabinet meetings, but you just mentioned USAID. And you've got to at least applaud Trump for doing something that we could never envisage, the destruction of USAID, which actually hurt organizations that were really Marxist around the world in favor of this fake communist left or this Clintonite left. I don't know what neoliberalism, globalism. It did so much to damage society outside the United States and within.
Well, absolutely. These are programs that have become sacrosanct. And so many of them were focused on contractors. And who were those contractors? Very often they were tied in with the liberal elite, Joe, you talk about. That's why I wish that that same force had been turned loose on the Pentagon. USAID is small cheese when it comes to small change when it comes to the expense. The Pentagon is huge. And of course, USAID, even when it wasted money, typically wasn't killing people. The Pentagon's job is to wage war around the world and to provide weapons to countries that are waging war. And, think of the numbers of people who died in that. And the waste of, $6 trillion on the Iraq war in Afghanistan. I mean, money that, you think about Americans not living well and, the infrastructure, et cetera. Well, when you take that much money and just kind of throw it to the wind, that helps explain it.
And of course, Trump was then, I know it's the four-year anniversary over the weekend of joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, four-year anniversary of the ending, the defeat of the United States in its longest war in its history. But then he was elected, Trump, to end wars. And this is from the FT a few days ago. Iran leader rules out direct talks with the U.S. Now, we don't know whether letting in some members of the IAEA were to do with snapback sanctions. I think we can assume the 400 kilos of enriched uranium have gone missing, not because they went missing because of the obliteration of Iran's nuclear program, because they probably have nuclear weapons. Who knows? Do you think Trump would really dare? Is it Miriam Adelson that's telling him, go to war with Iran, or will Israel be able to go unilaterally to war and bump Trump into it?
Well, it looked to me like he would prefer not to, but then he's easily manipulated into it. I mean, Netanyahu made a judgment that if he launched a war against Iran, that the U.S. would get pulled in, and guess what? The U.S. got pulled in. The Israelis didn't have the wherewithal to actually take out deeply buried facilities. Once it started, Trump saw it pretty hard to stay out. So I could see that happening again. There's a lot of talk.
But he was very careful. I know more than 1,000 people were killed in Iran, one has to say, in the various strikes. But he was very careful to choreograph with Iran the destruction. It was pitch-perfect aiming by Iran on the radar in Qatar. In the GCC country, I'm speaking to you from the GCC, it was more calibrated.
Well, I think what we saw was the war against Israel was not. I mean, the Iranians did a lot of damage. Israel actually suffered quite a bit in that. It's pretty clear the Iranians made a judgment. They didn't want to have full-scale war with the U.S. So they were willing to accept a certain amount of that, and then that's right. You kind of, here's our retaliation. By the way, we're about to do this. Nobody's going to die. I'm not sure that would happen again. If Trump would do a second round, the Iranians might decide that's not when they stand back. And then they could do enormous damage to American military facilities in the Middle East. So this is going to be a very interesting dance. I think the inspectors have gone back in because the Iranians are involved in talks with the Europeans about sanctions, but the IAEA said that they were going in under different guidelines or something. So my guess is that they're not seeing everything.
I mean, clearly Iran don't care. They said IAEA is full of spies for them, and they're represented at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Who cares about European sanctions or United States sanctions? I mean, India, for instance, did it make you laugh? I mean, what did you think? I mean, changing U.S.-India policy, the largest population in the world, on a dime like that. India just said no.
No, extraordinary.
You believe? You believe Modi didn't even take the calls to Donald Trump?
Actually, that would not surprise me. I think that from the Indian standpoint, the U.S. has spent a couple of decades trying to make friendly with India because the U.S. wants to pull them away from China and become a friend of the U.S., And then to have Trump do this with no warning. And it's not as if this is a consistent policy. You know, well, why not sanctions on China and Turkey for buying Russian oil? Why is the U.S. buying uranium? You know, what from Russia? Why do some of the European
from
countries
Russia.
Still buy oil?
Yeah, no one seems to realize.
Yes.
So the United States would have to sanction itself.
Yes, exactly. And it would have to sanction the European Union. So if you're Modi, you look at this and say, why am I the only one? Why are Indians? What is this? If it's immoral for us, how about everybody else? So I'm not surprised that Modi, this is a very nationalistic country. They're growing fast, the largest population. Country with a very long history of a non-aligned international policy. They matter a lot more. They're growing. Why on earth are they going to suffer being treated that way by Donald Trump?
Yeah, BRICS was getting worried by India's closeness to the Biden administration in terms of the defense pact it was forging, after all. But at the same time, what do you think, is this because of the people involved in the telling Trump of information? He didn't seem to even know about the attack on Nasser Hospital, which killed 5 journalists there. Another journalist was killed on the same day, all the paramedics in the double-tap strike. And perhaps he doesn't know what you just told me there about India. What do you think? Who are the filters here? Do you think Colonel Tulsi Gabbard would tell? You think J.D. Vance would tell him? Is it Rubio and John Ratcliffe at the CIA?
Yeah, I think that they are the main folks who would be telling these things. And my guess is they don't have any incentive to tell him that. You know, and he's not somebody who likes to be deeply briefed. On Israel, he's probably also hearing from, some other folks. I mean, he might be talking to the U.S. ambassador over there. He has family members and others that it's
Mike
pretty
Huckabee.
Good. He probably talks to Netanyahu. Yeah.
And what do you think of that ambassador, Trump's friend?
It's the most extraordinary. I mean, he's at the radical fringe of Christian belief in terms of end times theology with Israel. And to have, kind of hardcore, dispensationalist, Christian theology determining your foreign policy in the Middle East is a really scary thing. And that's where Huckabee is. He's off the charts.
Yeah. And then, people quite warmed to Witkoff when he cut a ceasefire in for the inauguration of Donald Trump, which shows that all it takes is a telephone call from the office where you used to work. It just takes a phone call to stop the genocide. And then Witkoff, his proposal was accepted by Hamas and then promptly dropped.
Yep.
What did you make of that? Again, the hand of Miriam Adelson, let alone Tom Barak in Lebanon insulting Lebanese people as Lebanese journalists and who knows, Lebanese people as animals.
Oh, that's right. I think that the Israel and Netanyahu have calculated very adeptly that no president, whether it's Biden or Trump, in the end is willing to take any meaningful sanction against Israel, which means the presidents can talk like till they're blue in the face, make demands, want things, but in the end, Israel can do what it wants and nothing will happen. So they're happy to say, okay, yeah, we're going to do that, and then they ignore it. I mean, I don't see anything else. When is the last time? I think that Biden stopped the delivery of a few heavy bombs or something, but it had nothing to, no impact on the war in Gaza. I mean, before that, you really have to go back to George H.W. Bush for a U.S. president who was serious and tried to stop Israel from some of its destructive actions.
Doug Bando, I'll stop you there. More from the former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former special assistant to U.S. President Ronald Reagan, Doug Bando. Doug, you've been criticizing Trump all through, really. Not fair. Tucker Carlson, he always appears as if he's going, yes, but, because there are things he does do. And you can tell that there are things he does that are good because Thomas Friedman, unkindly referred to as some kind of moron rather than a journalist in the Salzburger New York Times, says here, Ukraine diplomacy reveals how un-American Trump really is. I think it's an article about Alaska saying it's un-American to negotiate. I don't know whether you caught this. I mean, not many people read it, as Trump would say. You must have applauded, and you wrote about it, that it's a great thing he did by meeting Putin, rolling out the red carpet for him. But now he seems unable to follow through. Is that because, I mean, in the first place, did he have the Alaska meeting because he understands the stakes, unlike the European vassal states?
I think that Trump does understand the stakes. You know, and thankfully, he, you know, I think has come to understand that just asking for a ceasefire isn't going to get you anywhere. You know, that the problem is if you haven't solved the underlying issues and gotten a settlement, a ceasefire achieves nothing. So that at least seems to be something where the discussion in Alaska had an impact. Yeah, Trump really doesn't want a nuclear war. Trump understands this is a disastrous war that needs to be ended. And Trump, to his credit, realizes that Ukraine isn't going to get what it wants. It's not going to get Crimea back. It's not going to get the Donbass back. The problem is Donald Trump wants to be the one to settle it. But in the end, only Putin and you know, Zelensky, only the Ukrainians and Russians can ultimately settle this. So you know, he keeps wanting to meddle and put pressure and sanction. And it strikes me that's where he needs to step back, bring them together, but he can't settle it.
You mentioned nuclear war there. You know that in Western, especially NATO nations, where the press is banned, they don't have any freedom to watch any other narrative except the narrative that Putin is evil and Zelensky is some kind of god. Just mentioning the threat of nuclear conflict is a Russian talking point, according to NATO leaders. What do you think of that? And how does that contrast with how policymakers in Washington, in the Department of War, as Heck said, may rename it, let alone the White House, gauge it?
Well, I think dismissing the threat is deranged. You know, the problem is everybody seems to have come to the conclusion that Putin is really a wimp. He wouldn't dare go to nuclear weapons. He wouldn't dare escalate, et cetera. But what they forget is he believes he's winning. You know, and if you believe you're winning, you're not going to escalate. You're not going to, you know, broaden the war. You're not going to attack a NATO country. But what if he thinks he's losing? You know, what if, you know, the U.S. provides missiles that can hit Moscow? What if, you know, you start playing this out, there are a lot of scenarios where you can imagine Putin deciding, I've had enough. And then it becomes the game of, okay, I'm going to blow up the warehouse in Poland that has all those missiles you're sending to me. And, you know, I dare you, you know, to respond. And then you can imagine, I mean, the Europeans would all be wetting their pants and they'd all be coming to Washington saying, do something, do something, do something. And then the White House would have to say, are we prepared to risk escalating this further and getting the... I'm very concerned about this sense that, well, we can do anything that we want to Russia. You know, back in the election campaign in 2020, Joe Biden was complaining that the Trump administration had not done anything to Russia, which had allegedly been paying the Afghans to kill Americans, you know, at a time where like six Americans had been killed in the previous 6 months. You know, it seemed to be a false charge. But he was, you know, he was out there campaigning on this. What do you think the Russians think? They've had thousands of people killed because of Western weapons. I think that the proxy war with the nuclear armed power that's fighting over existential interest is a very dangerous thing.
Do you think that is in some way a way to explain Trump's seeming erratic performance on this issue? Because obviously he's being pulled by his golf partner, Senator Lindsey Graham, and as you said, Rubio and so on. After he said he wasn't going to send American weapons, there was literally within 24 hours a headline here saying U.S. offers air and command backup for Ukraine force, support for Europe's post-war shield, intelligence assets to protect troops. So I presume that headline comes from one part of the administration in Washington, while Trump says, look, we want to end the war, or maybe it's your... It seems to be zigzagging, but he... does get it that Putin's red line is if Russian civilians are being killed in Russia with American weapons bought by the European powers, Washington will be targeted.
Yeah, I think that he does recognize that this could escalate very dramatically. I think he very sincerely doesn't want nuclear war. I think he misses some of the subtleties here. He knows that the Russians don't want Ukraine in NATO. He doesn't seem to understand that, well, from a Russian standpoint, if the armed forces from NATO members are, you know, garrisoning Ukraine and the U.S. is backing them up, well, that looks an awful lot like being in NATO, even if you're not exactly in NATO. So, and I suspect the Europeans are doing their best to mislead on this, to say, oh, no, no, don't worry. This is completely different. This is peacekeeping. And, you know, it really worries me. I think you're right about the headlines that within his administration, there appear to be people on both sides. And I think he often is of two minds, where he's, well, the Europeans are finally spending more. I need to do something to encourage them. You know, or the Europeans will take this over if only I provide a little backing, but no troops on the ground. You know, these kinds of things that he doesn't have a sophisticated understanding and analysis of this. He's got the right instincts, but he doesn't have enough people around him, I think, who are thoroughly, you know, supportive and basically saying, step back and turn this over. We shouldn't keep our fingers in it.
And it's too much of a leap of the imagination for him to think, well, the security guarantee could be there if Russia joined NATO, as Putin once suggested in 2000. Too much of a leap of the imagination.
Exactly.
Rather like too much of a leap of the imagination to go and to China and join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, I mean, to his credit, of course, he's willing to do things that horrify official Washington. His willingness to meet with Kim Jong-un was one of those, which I thoroughly supported. But of course, official Washington was beside itself at the thought that he would actually, you know, dignify the North Koreans with a summit, when in fact, you know, 80 years, 70 years of not talking to the North Koreans really hadn't achieved very much. He understood that. The rest of Washington didn't.
Do you think that's because maybe, I mean, giving them the benefit of the doubt that they don't understand that Kim Jong-un could destroy Los Angeles in half an hour or whatever intel Trump got in the first term, which obviously alarmed him that that was one of the right at the top of the list of his priorities?
It's very strange. Almost everyone in the Korea policy community will admit there's no chance at all that we can imagine that Kim Jong-un will give up nuclear weapons. At the same time, they say, but of course, we have to continue to press North Korea to give up nuclear weapons. And they're horrified by the idea that maybe you would talk to North Korea and try to get goals short of that. Let's get a freeze. You know, we give you some sanctions relief if you freeze nuclear weapons production. My view is that's a major advantage. It's a step toward getting rid of them if you ever think that's possible. Let's go for that, as opposed to...
You think, you know, with President Lee, there's hope there then? Definitely hope there with President Lee.
Yes.
I
think that's right.
Meeting.
Exactly.
But of course, at the same time, it's this Adelson connection and the Israeli lobby. Ultimately, do you think his legacy is going to be that? Because you can see what his name means for all the peace, for all the avoidance of global annihilation through nuclear weapons. He will go down in history, won't he, for the genocide, the starvation in Gaza. I mean, his name in the UAE, where actually I think the UAE talks about Russia and the importance of Russia as a partner. It's quite obvious that the Global South is all appalled by what's going on.
I think it's extraordinary the damage done to America's reputation, also Europe's, but especially to the United States. I don't think he sees that. I think it's long-term damage. I'm not sure how to ever change that, you know, to basically have the blood of tens of thousands of people effectively on your hands, or and not just his, of course. I mean, it's Joe Biden. This is a policy that started under the earlier administration. But to see the carnage that has occurred in Gaza, you know, is just utterly horrendous. And it's no surprise that when the NATO countries and, you know, the U.S. went to them on Ukraine, you know, they basically looked and said, you too. Who are you to kind of moralize about the invasion of Ukraine when you invade Iraq and you, you know, kind of turn that country into a charnel house? And when you support Israel and you support Saudi Arabia against Yemen, I think America's reputation has been very badly damaged.
Saudi Arabia
and the tragedy.
Saudi Arabia calling it a genocide. We're running out of time, Doug. I don't know whether were you special assistant to Reagan when Reagan killed the then, Reagan called the then Israeli leader to stop killing Palestinians? Or was it the Lebanese?
I think that was a bit. That was the Lebanon. I think that was 83. I think that was after I left.
That was the Lebanon War.
I mean,
but what was it about Lebanon, Reagan, that against advice from the Israeli lobby, he thought he could ring Israel and say, presumably after Sabra and Shatila, maybe in 82, to just quit it?
That's right. No, I mean, he was horrified. And he understood America's responsibility. And to Reagan's credit, I mean, you know, same thing with dealing with Gorbachev. I mean, you know, some of his conservative supporters called him an appeaser. You know, and his desire to get rid of nuclear weapons. You know, he was horrified with the Pentagon briefing that said, you know, if the Soviets launch, all we can do is launch. And he sat there and said, oh, so all we can do is murder millions of Russian civilians. How on earth is that a good policy? So Reagan had that, and to some degree Trump does, but Reagan was determined to act on it, and he was willing to act on it against, you know, a lobby in America, against an American ally. Because what happened in Sabra and Shatila, those camps, was terrible. And he said, what was happening in Lebanon was terrible. The Israeli invasion was horribly destructive. So I think Reagan deserves credit there, where he was, you know, he's elected. People said, oh, he's a crazy cowboy, but he really wasn't. He very rarely used the military. He recognized that putting U.S. forces into Lebanon was a mistake. You read his diaries. He came to realize that was really a dumb idea. You know, and he avoided, you know, serious war with serious powers, thankfully.
Doug Mandow, aside from Central and Latin America, thank you.
Happy to be on. Take care.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU armed genocide in Gaza and the killing in Lebanon. We'll be back on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.